State, the morning show with Greg Berg up next. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A very harsh reality that many people have to live with is dementia. And the person themselves suffering from dementia is not the only person who suffers. Those that love them also are drawn into a very complicated web of challenges. And really, it's only when you're in the midst of that, experiencing it firsthand, that you can really fully understand just how drastically life changes and how life's relationships change as well. That is explored in a really interesting book called Being My Mom's Mom, A Journey Through Dementia from a Daughter's Perspective. It is written by Loretta Vini, and she has experienced this journey with her own mother, who suffers from dementia that appears to be of the sort that we associate with Alzheimer's. And it has been a difficult journey, but also in some respects an inspiring journey. And mother and daughter remain very, very close, albeit in a relationship that is very different from what it once was. In fact, a relationship, as the title suggests, which in some ways has flipped, in which now the daughter is, in effect, acting as the parent. We hear about this, but often we're not really taken into the heart of that experience emotionally, and we are in this book. Loretta Vini is going to be coming to Racine this weekend and speaking at First Presbyterian Church in downtown Racine on Friday night, the 11th of September at 7 p.m., and this presentation will be an opportunity for you to hear more from Loretta Vini and hear more about her story. And particularly if this is in any way a reality in your life or a reality that you anticipate someday, Loretta Vini has all kinds of help and encouragement that she can offer you. Again, the title of her book is Being My Mom's Mom, A Journey Through Dementia from a Daughter's Perspective. Loretta Vini, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg. I'm thrilled to be here.
I'm really glad we have this opportunity to talk about your really wonderful wonderful book. We don't have a lot of time to talk about this. You explore it in some detail in your book, but maybe you can just touch briefly on what you discuss in the first chapter of the book, which you call Our Pre-Dementia Life, in which you kind of sketch what life was like for you and for your mother growing up before dementia entered the picture. One of the first things you say is that you and your mom were, and maybe to some extent still are, complete opposites. How? How so?
We are complete opposites. I do everything quickly. I talk all the time. I talk really fast. And just was very outgoing. My mom is quite the opposite. She's very shy, doesn't like people much, very un-Loretta-like is what I tell people. And I used to always joke with her that if I hadn't been born at home, I would have thought that they had taken the wrong child home from the hospital. So we used to always really joke about that. My sister was very much like my mother, so I sort of was the odd person out, but I kept the house really lively. You know, I could always get my mom to laugh, and you know, she did a lot of things with us, I think, that were out of her comfort zone. You know, going to different events and things with us that had a lot of people, but she did it for us, and I truly appreciate, you know, all of the efforts that she did for us when we were young.
At one point you write, "I am amazed at how much my mom was able to do for us, even right. as a single parent." I mean, she went Absolutely. Above and beyond what maybe a lot of single parents would be able to accomplish.
She really did, and she did a lot of things, you know, found a lot of opportunities for us that were free, which, of course, fit into our budget. You know, being raised in Washington, D.C., there are a lot of free things, and the Smithsonian was not only our favorite place to visit, and the exhibits were always changing, so we were always learning something new, but it was a, you know, just a wonderful experience. She took us to all kinds of fairs. You know, they have a very big folklife festival here in D.C., so we just had so many what we call adventures that you know, really took a lot of sacrifice. And without a car, you know, we rode the bus everywhere, and sometimes she would splurge, and we would take a taxi. But just, you know, so many, you know, great things that we were exposed to that so many people that who grew up in our neighborhood were not. So that was, I mean, just fabulous.
Hmm. A couple of specifics I want to highlight. One of them is a lesson that she taught you that I think is really cute or really cool about credit versus layaway. And, I mean, it really underscores, you know, how wise your mom was, how intelligent mm-hmm. she was. And she had some very good practical skills that I'm sure served her well. Tell our listeners about her philosophy when it came to the matter of buying something on credit versus putting it on layaway.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I still remember that lesson well. And I try to, you know, do all my things today in that same campaign, sort of without the layaway. But her premise really was that if you put something on a credit card, you didn't really own it until you paid the bill off, which could take months and months and months and maybe even up to a year. But if you, and so it wasn't really yours, it still belonged to the store, even though you might have been wearing it or using it. Whereas if you put something in layaway and you paid for it, you know, every, you know, couple of weeks or once a month or whatever, by the time you actually got it out and took it home, it really was yours. And so you know, if you really got us to buy in, you know, to that. And I always remember that if you buy it on credit, you don't really own it yet. And that
right.
really stuck in, you know, really stuck in my mind. And a very interesting example of that is, you know, I got a car in 2013 with, I think, a four-year note, might have been a five-year note. But I paid it off in like 22 months. And then I went to get my mom to celebrate, and we took a picture in front of my now car that I owned. And she says, "Oh, this is a big deal. Do I get ice cream?" And the answer to that was yes. So we had ice cream to celebrate that. So I still carry those lessons with me today.
Your mom allowed you to do something at the tender age of 13. She allowed you to join the Book of the Month Club. And especially yes. listeners of a certain age will certainly know what that was all about.
Yes.
And that obviously was really important to you on a couple of different levels.
It was. Yeah, I think for me, I mean, I loved to read, you know, just couldn't get enough of books. And she really, you know, instilled that in us. And, you know, a lot of trust on her. You know, you got a booklet in the mail and you had to send it back by a prescribed time. And you know, she really trusted me not only to, you know, follow the guidelines of belonging, but also to, you know, select books that, you know, would enhance my learning, would expose me to a variety of different things and cultures and places, and still would get select items that she would approve of, is I guess how I would put that. And so it was a really great thing for us, and we would look through the magazine together, and it was just a really fun time for us. And you know, in line with the bargain, you know, books, I got things on sale, and I always only bought books I could afford, and we always looked at the prices. And so I learned so many lessons from that, and I still have some of those books today that I bought when I was in that club. And I just can't. Cleaned out a lot of things. We've been downsizing quite a bit, but some of those books that I got that really remind me of my mom, I've absolutely held on to.
Your childhood, as we already mentioned, was one in which you were raised almost the whole way by your mom as a single parent. Your mm-hmm. father was not on the scene, and you mm-hmm. never actually had the opportunity to meet your dad. On top of that difficulty was also the intrusion of some serious illness in your family and in a couple of different ways. And it was probably important that you, even as a youngster, witnessed some of what you did. For instance, the way your mother cared for your own grandmother in her yes. her last years. The fact that your sister, Renee, came down with multiple sclerosis. And also a beloved aunt who died too young from cancer. Do you think very much about the kind of impact that those kind of difficulties and losses had? I think this is the time we should talk about it ahead of talking about this journey through dementia with your mother. But what kind of difference do you think it has made in what you're experiencing now to have that, those kind of experiences also as part of your past?
That was a great question. I think one of the most impactful things I learned from that was to, for myself anyway, is to live every day as if it were your last. People always ask me, are you always this happy and excited and energetic? And the answer to that is typically yes, because you just never know when it'll be your last, day. And so I also learned how to say, get all your feelings out for people, never go home without saying I love you and things like that, because it is so important. And, especially with my aunt, when we knew she had been given specifically 6 months to live, my beloved Aunt Diane, who we had thought would help us to care for our mom because they were 19 years apart in age. And so, it certainly didn't play out that way. And so for my aunt, we just focused on keeping her happy, doing all the last little things she wanted to do. One of them was going to a casino. And so we did that, and just all kinds of things that I learned, giving people, what they need and want, especially when time is short, but also learning to say all of those things you really want to say. That helped tremendously with my sister, because we didn't have the best of relationships necessarily growing up. But as she was dying, I flew to L.A. and got there on time. But the bigger thing for me was that we said everything we needed to say, about our relationship, about how much we still loved each other. And one of the best things that I carry with me every day that my sister said to me before she died was that she loved me and I was doing a great job with mom. She could have great difficulty talking then, but she said mom and squeezed my hand and nodded her head, and I knew exactly what she meant. And I said, I'll take great care of her, and she nodded vigorously. And again, the next minute or so, she died. And so we got everything out, and so I have no regrets really about life and the care for my mom, and all of that. I think was instilled in watching my, my mom care for my, both my grandparents, really, but specifically my grandmother, who, died in the house I was born in. And so I think you carry all those things, with you, but they, they make you stronger. And so it gives me new energy to care for my mom. And that's, very important for me.
We're speaking with Loretta Vini, and we're talking about her experience of helping her mother through the difficult journey of dementia. She's written a book about it called Being My Mom's Mom. Loretta Vini is going to be speaking at First Presbyterian Church in downtown Racine this Friday night. Loretta Vini, when did you first begin to notice signs that something was amiss with your mom? What were some of those first small signs of dementia? Some of which were signs that that you and other people close to your mother probably missed or didn't understand at the time were symptoms of something much worse that was looming in her future.
Yeah, definitely. I think some of the first things, and you just, as you said, overlook it, was going to the grocery store. And we had gone to the same grocery store. My mother didn't like change, so we shopped at the same store. She wasn't interested in, shopping around for the best deals. We went to the same, store all the time. She knew every item that was on every aisle by heart. She would buy sale items, but it had to be at that store. And she would go up an aisle and, not remember where a particular item was. And in terms of writing a check, she couldn't remember the date and those kinds of things. I'm going, man, how interesting, because, she always got the same things, oatmeal, applesauce, all of the same items over and over. And so that was some of the really first things. And even that was unnerving to some degree, but not as much as some of the challenges she began to have, you know, in her own building. She, you know, ate at a dining hall where it was a cafeteria style, and she loved that. You know, they served, you know, whatever you asked for. And she always got chicken. They always had two or three different types of entrees every day, but she always got chicken. And so I got in the line with her one evening, and one of the workers said, "Oh, hi, Miss Woodward. You know, do you want your chicken?" And she looks around like she didn't know who Miss Woodward was. And that was kind of the first sign. But I didn't really know what to do with that. It scared me, but I wasn't sure what to do. And she seemed unnerved by it, too. She looked surprised. She looked a little uncomfortable. And I felt like it might have been the first time she didn't know where she was, looking back, of course. But because I didn't know what to do or how to handle it, I just kept talking fast and moved on, you know, with life. And so, you know, obviously if I could do that over, maybe I'd try to look into it a little more, because she did look lost. And I know I use that word in the book, that she appeared lost for the very first time.
Right.
Even though we were sitting right across from each other. And so, yeah, I think today, of course, when you know these things, you know, you certainly would have done something, you know, very different from, you know, what I actually did.
I was struck how you talk about how some of the most serious alarm bells went off when she would forget things that were so important to her. I mean, for instance, yeah, you know, walking through that little cafeteria line, "Do you want your usual chicken, Mrs. Woodward?"
Right.
You know, I mean, do I like chicken? I mean, you know, I mean, it's one thing to forget something sort of incidental, but when you start forgetting things that matter to you, or the first time she forgot to go to Tai Chi class. I remember you saying your mom really loved Tai Chi for some reason, and the first time she just completely forgot to even go on her Tuesday Tai Chi class.
Right.
I mean, that was an indication, I'm sure, that this is perhaps something a little more serious.
That was the really, you know, big thing, because she wouldn't even schedule anything. Tai Chi was, you know, 2 or 3 in the afternoon, so if she wanted to go to lunch or breakfast, "Oh, no, it's Tai Chi day." Like, okay, well, Tai Chi is like hours from now. But she was afraid, you know, she would go out and, you know, miss it, and we'd get stuck in traffic or something. So she wouldn't go out of the house until the exercise classes had come and gone. So, yeah, I think that was one of the biggest uh-oh moments for me.
So how old was your mother when she was finally taken to the doctor specifically for the purpose of sort of ascertaining what was wrong and if indeed there was sort of a serious problem afoot? How old was she at that point?
She was 77.
Hmm.
And so that scene, people say, "Oh, you know, that's old enough," you know, kind of thing. That's kind of a great age, I guess, if you're going to get it. But it was shocking for us, because she was the first one in our family, you know, first of all, but also, you know, they lived so long in our family that seemed like she was still a teenager. Because I immediately began thinking, we're going to have to find a new place and that kind of thing, although I thought it would go a little more slowly.
Hmm.
And so that was quite concerning, that, you know, she was getting it at 77, when in our family they lived so long that she could potentially go, you know, 10 or 15 years in that condition. So that was a little scary, that she would, you know, because I had no idea what care would cost or what it would look like. So in my mind, I was adding, you know, pretty much financially how much, you know, it might cost, because I thought my mother would outlive her money, basically. And so I began planning for that almost right away.
You offer up, at this point in the book, a couple of very, very interesting and I think potentially really helpful ideas for people who find themselves in your situation, caring for a loved one and finding the relationship, in a sense, beginning to reverse or flip, where the child begins to have to parent their own parent. And again, this probably shifts over time as the debilitation becomes more serious. But one of the things you write very early on, I mean, shortly after this diagnosis is made and so on, and this reality is beginning to sink in, at this point when you begin basically accompanying her on every appointment and, for the most part, making all of her most important decisions, You said, mm-hmm. I tried to grant her a few moments of independence right. whenever I could. So in the mm-hmm. early going, when this was already serious, but not as serious as it would become, what kinds of mm-hmm. things would you do to give your mom moments mm-hmm. of independence?
Yeah, I would try to let her, you know, go to the restroom, you know, by herself instead of following her, you know, in there. And, you know, things like that. At the grocery store, I still let her pay, even though, you know, I was right there. And I would give her the information to write the check, and I would look at it to make sure it was the correct amount, that kind of thing. So she still felt like, you know, she was in charge. And then the doctor we eventually settled on, the neurologist, one of the things I loved the most about her was the fact that she and her, my mom had her own time. So she would ask my mom all the questions, all the typical things, what's the day, what's the month, who's the president, and none of which, of course, she could answer. But I never interrupted or anything. They had their own little time. And then after she was finished with the questions, all of which she got wrong, of course, then she would say, can I talk to your daughter for a few minutes? And my mom would say, yes. And then we would have our own conversation. And of course, I would correct everything she said. So she felt like she was, you know, in charge, and good for her.
Right.
So, you know, even to this day, I let her, you know, brush her hair, you know, and it doesn't always look like I would probably do it, but she did it, and okay, good. And so if we're going somewhere important, then I'll pull her hair back. She has fairly long hair. It's really flowing, you know, white hair. So still try to do those kinds of things that I know she would want, you know, if she was, you know, still making all the decisions.
Right. You also talk about the way in which, especially early on, the way in which you communicated with your mother, in a sense, needed to change. You write that, you know, under difficult circumstances, for instance, when you had to take over the checkbook, for instance, which mm-hmm. you tell us was a really, really difficult moment for both of you. You write, I have learned that these kind of circumstances involving direct and careful speech require the right timing and the right words. I found it very helpful to write down what I wanted to say and then practice before delivering it. I've read a lot of books that offer up thoughts and advice, but I've never seen that advice shared before. It makes a lot of sense. Tell us more about how that has played out.
Oh, it has gone really well. Thankfully, my mother never drove, so some of the most difficult things people talk about, telling mom they can't drive anymore, really was something that I got to avoid. But even so, even some things that don't seem big to us are big to our, you know, our parents. And so I felt it was, you know, in the best interest of both of us, I wouldn't really upset her, to practice. So writing it down was very helpful, because when people get nervous, if it's a difficult conversation, especially if the other person gets angry right away, then, you know, you look back at your piece of paper with the words on it and you stay focused. And that has really been a great help. And so now, you know, back then it was about the checkbook and, you know, why you couldn't write checks anymore and why I had to do it. And then it kind of progressed to now you have to move and that kind of thing. So that I practiced a lot. You know, the part about moving her from a place that she loved with her classes and her friends and all those things. And so it was very helpful. I mean, there were still tears, especially with the moving, but she understood. And we held hands as we left her, you know, building. And, you know, she didn't like it, but she, you know, understood. And she said, thank you for explaining it all to me. Yes. And so, yeah, she, you know, loves that. And even today she'll say, why did I have to move again? I said, because it wasn't safe where you were, living by yourself. Okay. And so she, you know, plays along. But, the practicing was great. And so my husband and daughter have been fabulous in, you know, rehearsing and, you know, and things with me. And it has really made things, you know, much easier. And so that's been, you know, great. And if it's something minute, you know, what do you want her to wear and that kind of thing, like she'll have on one color top and it doesn't necessarily match the pants. But, you know, I think these are little things. And, you know, I'm not going to stress about those. So even though if they don't match perfectly, it's okay. We'll go to the store anyway. And people understand. And so some, you know, I just choose my battles. And if it's a really big deal, you know, I'll just write it down and practice. But, yeah, that's probably one of the biggest things I think that saved us a lot of, you know, angst and discomfort and all that. It's been really helpful for me.
Sure. Another bit of advice that I think is so helpful is when you talk about the importance of sharing with your mom a card, a particular card. And this was relatively early. You write, because of my mom's dementia, I wanted to get a card that she could read repeatedly.
Yeah.
So to be reminded of how I felt about her and what I was attempting to do. What a great idea. Did anything in particular spark that idea in your mind?
We loved, we loved picking out cards. And my mom always tried to get for her friends those real sentimental cards that they could read over and over, like if they got diagnosed with some dreaded thing. You know, it would say, you know, keep your head up, those kinds of things. And she loved that. And we would, you know, spend quite a bit of time, you know, reading them, and she's, no, that's not quite the right one. So she'd take her time and pick it out. And so I knew she would appreciate a call. And one of the things that's really funny that we learned when we were little, if people gave you anything, I mean anything, a paper clip, she made you write a thank you note. And so she was always big on these cards and recognizing people's feelings and always being cognizant of that. And so that card was really important. So the words were just perfect, you know, as I think I said in the book. It really said everything I wanted to say to my mom. And then I wrote my own note, you know, in my handwriting, which I knew she would recognize, really just to say, you know, I love you. I won't force you to do anything. I'm never going to hurt you. Because I think they get so afraid sometimes. What's going on? I just don't understand. And, you know, the card is still to this day up on her dresser. And I know she still reads it. And I don't think she understands it at all now. But she does still, you know, read it. So I hope somewhere in there, you know, she'll hear it. Because she'll get to the end and she'll say, love Loretta, which is how it sounds. And she'll say, who's Loretta? And then I'll say, me. And she'll say, yay. And then, you know, we just kind of go with it. She had, oh, my, she's so cute.
Wow.
But she's, and then I'll say, I'm your daughter. And she'll say, oh. So. Just a lot of that.
Yeah. At the end of this card, yeah, you very specifically write after the beautiful words of the card itself, then you add your own very simple, beautiful words. Dear Mom, please read this card when you are feeling down and always remember, one, I have your best interest at heart. Two, I would never do anything to hurt you. Three, I won't force you to do anything. Four, I love you more than anything. Love, Loretta. That's really cool. And it seems like you stopped to think about what would be most comforting to my mom on one of those days when things get really scary.
Yes. And I think it really worked. She was telling her, still to this day, best friend, that the card meant so much, and she would hold on to it whenever, you know, she was down. And so the friend related that to me later. So, yeah, I think it really means a lot to her, just her piece of, you know, strength. I believe is a good thing to say, yeah. A
couple bits, other bits of advice that I want us to touch on at least briefly. And, of course, when you come and speak in Racine on Friday night, you can go into much of this in more detail. One of your thoughts is that when it's time to make a decision, make it quickly. And, of course, that you know, we just at first we read those words and think, well, what does that mean? Why should we make an important decision quickly? But actually, there is a real reason why making decisions quickly and decisively can make a huge difference.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's, I think, you know, when you know something's wrong and, you know, when you prolong making decisions, bad things can really happen. And so I knew I should have been looking around for the place that she would live next and that kind of thing. So I think the biggest thing for me was the fact that, you know, I almost went into a serious problem without meaning to wait to get her to a safer place. And I just lucked into it that a friend of a friend, you know, had a group home that was just perfect for my mom. But when I say waited too long, the place where she lived, it took another resident who was a good friend of my mom's to sit me down and say, did the management call you from the non-assisted living place? And I said, no. And then she explained some of the things my mom was unable to do now, and that was to, after dinner, which was on the first floor in the lobby, to get back up to the fifth floor, which is where her apartment was. And she would sit, you know, in one place and outside the dining hall until she could figure out where her apartment was. And I just felt horrible. I instantly started to cry. that, you know, I had let it go on that long. So then I paid someone to stay with her 24 hours while my husband and I ran around like chickens with our head cut off to find a place. We had promised my mom, because, you know, listeners might be thinking, why didn't you just take her to your house? We had promised our mother that we would never force her to live with us, and she made us sign a document about that. And so me finding a place for her that I knew she would be comfortable was just a high priority for me, to give her that wish, and as we had said earlier, keep her with that dignity and everything that she had asked for. She lived with her parents for almost her entire adult life and never wanted to do that to her kids.
Mm-hmm.
So
you end up moving her,
played out.
You end up moving her to a place called Mamie's Loving Care. And I thought one of the most interesting things that that was part of that experience was what Mamie insisted on in terms
yes.
of when you guys first moved in. She told you to to, you know, drop off her your mother's
yes.
stuff into the room, and then you were supposed to leave, which felt so wrong. But explain why that was Mamie's policy at Mamie's Loving Care.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was quite offended, you know, in a way, until she explained it. But really, it was so that there could be bonding between the caregivers there. There are two primary caregivers that live in the home. It's a single-family home. It's almost exactly the same layout as my home, and it's like 10 minutes from me. But she insisted that, you know, we leave, you know, right away so that not only can they get acquainted and have quiet time, but also help her put her things away so that they knew where the items would be. So, you know, if she needed something quickly, change the clothes or something, they can go right to the place and get it. If I put stuff away and hung around and just made it more difficult to leave, that gets the person off to, you know, kind of a bad start. So I didn't prolong it, but it was so nerve-wracking. I felt like, you know, dropping my child at kindergarten or something. So I guess that's how parents feel on the first day of school. And so I did what she said, and it was, the funniest part was that they were sitting around the dining room table, which was my favorite part of the house, and they were having cookies with my mom, which she loved. So sheer bribery, of course, to get her to stay. And so, you know, I want a hug before I leave. And but she's eating this cookie. So I said, Mom, do I get a hug? Well, no, I'm eating cookies right now. I'll hug you next time. And, you know, and they just laughed. And she was having such a good time. And I got to my car, and I remember crying like, oh, no. But she seemed so happy, you know, eating that cookie. And she barely waved at me. And so I knew we had really made the right decision. And to this day, they love her to death. And so it's still just a fabulous place that gives her everything I think she's always wanted. There's very few people. There are group homes in Maryland. Some places can have up to 15 people. That would drive my mother crazy. This place is a state approved for 7. There's never been more than 5 people there since my mom's been there. And that's just the right place for her. They all sit around the table and eat together. They say the same thing over and over every night. Look at the weather, you know. Look out the window. Oh, look at that tree. You know, that kind of stuff.
Hmm.
And but they have such a great time. And that works for me. And so, you know, it was hard, you know, so, you know, leaving her seemingly right, just dropping her and going. But I understood the rule. And so we certainly wanted to abide by all of that. But it was not easy.
We're speaking with Loretta Vini about her book, Being My Mom's Mom, A Journey Through Dementia from a Daughter's Perspective. In a chapter in which you share what you call Loretta-isms, some different sort of practical bits of advice about staying positive, and these include things like focus on the memories, and today may be better than yesterday, this day is almost over, it was a great night.
Yeah.
But I want to take a moment to talk about what I think is in some ways the most valuable of these bits of advice. It involves taking photographs. And again, this is something that I haven't heard suggested before, and it makes all the sense in the world. Explain to our listeners how the taking of photographs, I mean, probably hundreds, maybe thousands of photographs by now, has made a huge difference in your experience with your mom through her journey of dementia.
Absolutely. It's one of the best things ever. The funniest thing is, you know, mom can be, she's not really, you know, we don't have big behavioral issues, but she can be confrontational when she thinks you're not telling the truth. And so, you know, she's big on desserts and sweets and all those kind of things. And so, you know, if we've just done an event, whatever it is, we had dessert or we went to a show or we went somewhere. And she was like, I'd love to have, you know, some dessert. Did I have dessert? Yes, you did. And then she'll challenge you. What did I have? Or I don't remember. Or, you know, I think you're not telling the truth. And I whip out the picture of that apple pie, and she'll look at it. She'll say, oh, that looks good. Did I like that? Yes, you did. And we just laugh hysterically. And so it really keeps the, you know, behavioral things, like, you know, well, you're lying. You're not telling me the truth. Well, you made that up. Or, you know, and the scary part is that she obviously doesn't feel full. So the pictures have really saved us. And, you know, Easter Sunday, for example, we did a Easter egg hunt the last 2 years with my granddaughter, who was two and this year three. And so they run around doing the Easter egg hunt and finding eggs and everything. And I have all kinds of pictures of that in my presentation for Friday. And, you know, minutes later when it's over, you know, she doesn't have a clue of, you know, what we did. I said, wasn't that Easter egg hunt fun? Oh, and of course she doesn't even remember what an Easter egg hunt is, much less having done one. And so she'll, you know, I'll show all the pictures. Look at all those eggs in my basket. Yeah. Did I find all of those? Yes, you did. And so she says, yay me. She says that a lot. Yay me. And so we cheer her. So the pictures are just awesome. Because, I mean, some of the pictures of my mother and my granddaughter playing together virtually, and neither one of them have long attention spans, but they can play for, you know, 20, 30 minutes, and they can't do anything else, you know, in that time frame. And so we've had all kinds of pictures of them throwing the ball and, you know, doing the Easter eggs, playing with Legos, which is a huge thing in our family. And so amazing.
Hmm.
Absolutely amazing. And the pictures have really been a godsend for sure.
When it comes to your mother completely forgetting something that she has just done, one of the ways in which that played out in a way that I'm sure in the moment almost felt kind of tragic was when you took her to see one of the greatest dance groups in the world.
Yes.
and a group that your mom absolutely loved.
Love.
And you shelled out a lot of money for front row seats. Describe to our listeners what we're talking about and what happened.
Sure. We went to see the Alvin Ailey dance troupe, and we'd done it every year as a family from when my daughter was a teenager. And so just one of those family traditions. And one of the things I say in the book is that you really have to let go of some of the traditions. But I, because it never worked out exactly the same way. So we'd gone, we sat in the front row, and when her favorite dance came, it's called Revelations, and it's with all these huge hats, and the women are bobbing their heads, so the hats go up and down just right to the music. I mean, it's fabulous. But I noticed when it came on, I said, here's your favorite dance. And she was just staring straight ahead like she didn't recognize it at all. And so I was so disappointed. And so at the end, you know, we're leaving, and she sees the program in her hand, and she says, oh, you used to take me to see this all the time. Why don't you take me anymore? And I said, we just came from. And she really got angry. She said, that's my favorite group. If we had been to see it, I'd remember. And she ran away from me, the first time she'd ever run from me. And the tragic part was that my leg was broken, so I couldn't chase after her. But someone that was witnessing this caught on and ran up the aisle and got my mother and brought her back to me. So we sat on the steps of the Kennedy Center and had this, you know, long talk, and I went through the program. She said, I guess you did take me. I just don't remember. And it was just, it really was tragic. So we got in the line for the ladies' room, and I was trying to explain each dance and how everything had happened. And you never know when people are listening to you. And there was a lady behind me who clearly was, you know, overhearing our entire conversation. I guess I had skipped part that she thought was important. So I was going on to the next dance, and she said, don't forget when they did so-and-so. And I said, oh, yeah. And so we hugged and everything. And she clearly either had a very close family relationship with dementia or whatever, but she understood exactly what I was trying to do. And so my mom and I hugged, and, you know, we shed a few, you know, tears. I was really distraught. But we never went again. I thought it was a very expensive lesson to learn, and she was really hurt that she thought I was trying to deceive her, that something that had just ended. It hadn't even been 2 minutes. We were walking up the aisle with the programs in hand, and everyone was saying how great it was. And by then, it had totally gone out of her head. So, I think that's one of the biggest things of the book is, you know, to sort of let go of some of the family traditions, because then it becomes about us.
Right.
Not about them.
And it heightens your sense of loss. in a sense, when absolutely. They no longer can experience absolutely. It and enjoy it. So now you say that you really, now when you have fun with your mom, you try to do free things with your mom,
correct.
Because then there's
correct.
None of that guilt where she feels badly right. that you've paid a lot of money for something that has...
And she didn't remember. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Tell our listeners about some of the experiences you've had now with your mom in this state of dementia when it comes to things like opening Christmas presents.
Yeah, that's really... We still give her gifts, as long as it doesn't... We don't give her a lot, one or two things, because it confuses her otherwise, but she'll... You know, she's always kind of saved the Christmas paper anyway, so she would open it and say, oh, a puzzle, oh, a book, and then she would close the paper up again, and then other people would be having conversation, and she said, oh, a present. Is this for me? Yes, it's for you. Oh, let's see what it is. And she, you know, unwraps the paper again and looks at, oh, a puzzle, oh, a book. And she has the same reaction each time that she sees whatever it is. So it's amazing that that happens, and she, you know, just loves it as much, you know, as the first 20 times that she looked at it. And then eventually, you know, we take it from her and put it somewhere else until, you know, it's time to take her home and that kind of thing. And that way it doesn't monopolize the whole visit, because anything that you put in her hands distracts her. So you either have to want her to hear her discuss it each and every time, or, you know, you put it somewhere where it won't upset her or challenge, because she'll say, who is this? This isn't mine. So sometimes she'll get a little anxiety-filled about whatever it's, you know, whatever she's holding, and even though it was intended to be a gift to make her happy. So you have to really walk that fine line between something that is really going to make her happy and give her, you know, pleasure or whatever, or something that's really going to give her a lot of anxiety and angst of returning in this to whoever it belongs to. And we get that a lot. And so you really have to walk that line. It's different every day.
Hmm. One of the things you remind us in the book is that a silver lining to all this is the fact that your mother, for all the things that she is forgetting that you wish she wouldn't forget, is forgetting certain things in which it is sort of a blessing, including
yeah.
certain things that have caused her great fear in the past or great stress or great regret or guilt. Mm-hmm. A lot of those things are falling away. And
yeah.
in a sense, what a blessing. Just give our listeners
yes.
one or two examples of that.
I think one of the even more now than the book came out. I think one of the blessings, of course, is the fact that by the time my sister got sick with multiple sclerosis, by then my mother was forgetting that she had two kids. And so when my sister, when you get MS in your 50s, you pretty much, it goes really fast. So she didn't even live 4 years. So when my sister was dying, you know, I had conversations with my mom's doctor, and we decided, you know, that it wouldn't be smart to, you know, share that with my mom. So one of the beauties was that my sister died. We didn't have to tell her that. And people react to that different ways. Oh, my God, what do you mean you didn't tell your mother, you know, your sister died? Well, what's she going to do with that information? And so that would be the one thing she would remember. And then, you know, she would cry all the time and that kind of thing. And for us, it wasn't worth it. And she never asked about her or anything. There are pictures up of all of us, you know, the two of us and, you know, the rest of the family on her dresser. And she never asked about it. If you point to her, she has no idea who my sister is. So I think that's one of the greatest blessings for us. And she also doesn't remember the years and years that I was sick. I had a ton of operations, and in her own way, I think my mother felt responsible for some of that. And thankfully, just in the last couple of years, she has finally forgotten that. And so I'm grateful for that, too. And so there really have been some tiny blessings. I consider the one with my sister huge, because, you know, that is one of the greatest traumas for a parent, you know, they say, to lose a child. So that is, you know, one of the things I'm just absolutely grateful for. And if she, you know, if she ever asks me about it, you know, in the future, which I doubt, but if she does, you know, I'll deal with it. Mm-hmm. You know, if she went away or, you know, whatever. And so, you know, we'll see, but I doubt it'll ever happen.
One of the closing thoughts in the book is this. While I was never blessed with giving birth to children of my own, God mm-hmm. has entrusted me with being my mom's mom.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
No matter what awaits me and my mom in the future, I pray that I'll continue to have the love, strength, and courage to be the best mom for her I can be. I'm just curious, do you talk about it with your mom in those terms? Do you ever openly with your mom refer to yourself as her mom or as her parent? Or is that something that would be just too confusing for her?
That's a great question. We don't talk about it in those terms. However, my mother is the person that came up with the title for the book.
Really?
I tell you, before dementia, I don't think this woman had ever been to a McDonald's, ever. But now it's like her favorite restaurant. So one day, we're in the McDonald's, and, you know, I'm trying to do the parent thing and get us to get the, you know, salad as opposed to the french fries. So she gets them out. She says, "Can I get an apple pie?" And I say, "Yes, but you have to eat all the rest of your lunch first." And the cashier bursts out laughing. So my mother looks at the cashier and she says, "I used to be her mom and now she's mine." And the lady just falls out. And I said, "I'm going to write a book about you." That's how I started. And I tell her, that's how I start every presentation. She came up with the title of the book. That, you know, I used to be her mom and now she's mine. And every now and then she'll say, "I'm still your mother," but she hasn't said that in a couple. It's been more than a year now that she hasn't recognized me. And so it's, really, you know, interesting dynamic. So we don't talk about it in those terms. She has a great sense of humor about it. She is very aware. She doesn't use the word dementia, but she is very aware that she can't remember things from one minute to the next. So she's very aware of that.
Mm.
So we don't talk about it in those terms, per se, of me being the mom and that kind of thing. But she is aware that I make all the important decisions and that kind of thing.
Right.
And she seems fine with it.
Well, it's really an inspiring, wonderful story. And, of course, it's not just inspiring, but also in your book and in the course of the story, you also share a lot of really powerful information that can really be helpful to people in a very tangible way. Your book even goes into such matters as living will and power of attorney and so on, some of those matters, which are also play an important role in your mom's well-being and in your ability to take care of her. We want to remind people that you are coming to Racine, to First Presbyterian Church, on a Friday evening, the 11th of September at 7 p.m. To talk about your story and to talk about more that's found in your book, Being My Mom's Mom, A Journey Through Dementia from a Daughter's Perspective. Loretta Vini, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me about your very important and beautiful story. I thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg. I really appreciate it. I had a great time. Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it's the monthly visit of the United Environmental Council and Nan Calvert. We're going to be speaking on tomorrow's program with Mark Shepherd about something called restoration agriculture. And on Friday, we'll spend most of The Morning Show broadcasting live from the construction site of the new Dream Playground on the north side of Kenosha. Also part of Friday's Morning Show, a preview of a marvelous documentary airing next week on the PBS series American Experience, a two-part documentary devoted to one of the great geniuses of the 20th century, Walt Disney, a genius with a dark side. His complex and fascinating story told in this documentary, and I speak with the director and producer on Friday's Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. Click on Talk. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street. Online at andreasgifts.com. Our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois calls for sunny skies today and high temperature in the mid-70s. Clear tonight, our low will be right around 55. Tomorrow, Thursday, mostly cloudy with a 50% chance of showers, possibly even a thunderstorm, high of 76. Thursday night, a 50% chance of rain, low in the mid-50s. Friday will be mostly cloudy, but Saturday and Sunday should be mostly sunny. And daytime highs Saturday and Sunday in the mid to upper 60s. This is WGTD